left.
He didn't. I had to return home for a week or two as my sister fell ill. When I came back, Jakub had already left.
Before you went home, did you notice anything different about him? His manner, his routine, anything that might indicate he had problems?
Pavel shrugged. He wasn't around that much, so hard to know his normal self, but he did ask me not to mention his name if anyone came looking here.
Who did he mean?
I wasn't sure at the time. He just said I was to pretend I did not know him. He asked Pat to do the same thing, and she agreed. She said she was used to doing that.
Pavel frowned.
One day, a big guy came by.
Pavel indicated a foot above his own head with a flat hand.
He said he was looking for his friend, Jakub Jasinski. Pat wasn't in, so it was left to me to speak to the man. I didn't like the look of him. Sly eyes. I told him I'd never heard of Jakub.
Did you by any chance get this guy's name? Brewster asked hopefully.
Sorry. Pavel shrugged. I wanted to get rid of him, not strike up a conversation.
Brewster said, did you inform Jakub that someone was looking for him?
Yes. I described him and, I don't know, something about his face losing color. I think he knew who this person was. But he gathered himself and said he did not recognize him.
So, when you came back from your trip home, where did you assume Jakub had gone? Helena asked.
I thought maybe he had gone back to Poland. Maybe it was his family he didn't want to find him. Or maybe he went back there between then and now. Who knows?
Helena said, Jakub seemed close to his family. I called Mrs. Jasinski before we began to investigate the case again to check Jakub hadn't turned up back in Poland, but she said not.
Pavel nodded. People come and go, moving place to place, trying to find the happy life they came here for.
He looked down at the floor, his face sagging. Brewster handed him a card.
If anything else occurs to you, no matter how small, please do get in touch. We'd be very grateful.
They thanked him and moved towards the door. Outside, Brewster took a call from the station.
Righto, he said. Sounds interesting. Cheers, bud. Leave it on my desk.
He looked at Helena.
Information called in by a member of the public, boss, he said. Fancy a McDonald's before we head back.
Chapter 19. Kate. The school's head teacher, Colette Greer, called me mid-morning.
I've been talking to social services, and we think, under the circumstances, it might be best for Alex to come into school.
Oh, yes, of course. I thought it might be a bit much for him, worrying about his mum.
As a teaching assistant, I probably should have known better and checked with the school before making a decision. I kept Tansy off to keep him company and... Sorry, I'll bring them both in.
No need to apologise. I know everything was up in the air last night, Colette said, but as you know, it can be better to distract children rather than give them too much time to dwell on distressing matters.
She hesitated. As I understand it, there's still no sign of Ms. Barros.
Not yet, I said. It doesn't seem the police have very much to go on,
except for Michael's keys being in her cottage when they shouldn't have been.
I think social services will be in touch shortly regarding arrangements for Alex, she said. It must be stressful for you trying to cope with his emotional state.
I don't mind, really, but thanks for calling. I'll bring the children in after lunch. In the living room, the news was not received well.
But you said we could stay home and play here,
Tansy said crossly when I told her to get ready.
Alex wants to wait here until his mummy comes back, don't you, Alex?
Yes, he agreed. Tansy, enough, I said sternly. I looked at Alex. If your mummy is found while you're at school, you'll be brought straight home to see her, okay?
He nodded. I took them into school in time for the afternoon registration, and Miss Monsall called me at afternoon break.
Tansy and Alex are fine, she said. I just wanted to put your mind at ease, as I thought you'd be worrying.
That's good of you, thank you, I said, breathing out again.
I've been thinking about Alex since I dropped him off. He seems to be coping quite well, she said. Tansy, on the other hand, is, well, she seems to be in protection mode, and she's managing to fall out with everyone who so much as looks Alex's way. Oh, no, she's just worried about him, I think. She's a good friend. Of course, Miss Monsall hesitated. Sadly, Tansy and Ellie seem to be at loggerheads. Nothing serious, just some unkind words, a bit of backbiting. I thought you could talk about it when she gets home. I clenched my teeth. Ellie could be such a spoilt little brat, jealous if Tansy didn't give her all her attention. Thanks, I will, I said. I'll also have a word with Donna and ask her to rein Ellie in a bit. It was time Donna admitted that her little angel could also be a dominating diva at times. Oh, no, sorry. I didn't make it clear. Ellie has been in tears because Tansy has been unkind. She's told Ellie not to go near Alex or she'll hit her. The anger drained from me in seconds, and I gripped the phone hard as I heard myself make appropriate shocked noises. When the call had ended, I just stood for a moment, thinking it through. Tansy wasn't a bully, and she didn't usually go around threatening people, especially her best friend. She must be feeling stressed and responsible for Alex in some way. Had I somehow subconsciously placed that burden on her young shoulders? Chapter 20. Nottinghamshire Police. Helena shrugged her jacket off and draped it over the back of her desk chair and yawned. It was all systems go now the Barros woman's disappearance had landed on their plate. She'd woken in the early hours and ran through the little they knew so far until it was time to get up at 6. So, Brewster, what's the latest on the Barros case? Her colleague ran a hand through his thinning red hair. Helena spotted a mustard stain from his impromptu McDonald's on his shirt. She chose to ignore it. She'd never seen him leave the station without something or other smeared on some part of him.
Not much. The problem is, boss, we know nothing about her. No Facebook, Instagram, or anything else along those lines.
It's not escaped my notice that she's a Polish national like Jakub Jasinski, Helena murmured, glancing at a printout one of her team had left on her desk. But there's a thriving Polish community in Nottinghamshire, so that might not mean anything in itself.
It's as if she just landed here from Mars, Brewster added. This is someone who didn't just want a fresh start like Jakub did. She's gone to great lengths to excise anything that went before.
We've got immigration tracing her address in Poland, but until that comes in, we've nothing at all.
Brewster shook his head regretfully. Absolutely nada. The only person who knows anything at all about her is the boy, her son, Alex.
Helena referred to her notes. And he's staying with friends?
Yes, he's staying at the Shaw's house. Shaw's wife, Kate, is fully police-checked and is apparently well-respected in the village, and their daughter is in Alex's class at school.
Hmm. Helena tapped her pen on the desk. Alex is the obvious place to start. I'll contact Kate Shaw and tell her we want to speak to the boy.
Okay.
Brewster dragged out the word, sounding unconvinced.
He's only 6 years old, so we'll have to tread carefully.
I'm aware of that, Brewster. We'll ask Kate Shaw to stay with him as his responsible adult so he feels supported. It might be worthwhile speaking to the school also.
Perfect. I can book a room at the station and get him in here.
Helena sucked in air. No, no, that won't do at all. We'll need to speak to him in a place he's familiar with and feels relaxed. Maybe at the family home where he's staying?
Right, of course. I'll see what I can do.
Helena busied herself with paperwork. Brewster left the office, and after a few minutes, he reappeared with two coffees. He placed one on her desk, then pulled a pack of mini cheddars out of his pocket.
Any luck?
He tore open the packet and offered it to her. No thanks, Brewster. She watched as his chunky fingers delved greedily into the pack. She picked up her phone and waved it at him. I've just got to get Kate Shaw on board with it. You can take those back to your desk. But before she could press the call button, Brewster was back,
his eyes wide. He waved a piece of paper at her.
This is the info called in earlier, boss. Anonymous caller on an unregistered phone.
He held up the message written by the desk clerk. If you're interested in finding Jakub Jasinski, ask Michael Shaw at Wadebridge, Linwick. Helena put down the phone and took the paper.
This is Kate Shaw's husband, right? Lives in the house where young Alex Barros is sheltering.
Brewster nodded.
He's the property and land manager up at Wadebridge. Uniforms spoke to Shaw as part of the door-to-door, and he answered all their questions. But they felt his wife was surprised to hear about contact he'd had with Susie. Visits to her cottage that he hadn't mentioned to her. Plus, his keys found in there.
I fear your mini cheddars are going to have to wait, Brewster. The press will slaughter us if they discover we left Susie Barros's son in the care of a man who we'd had a tip-off about.
She stood up and slipped on her jacket.
Detective Superintendent Gray needs to know about this right away.
Chapter 21. Irene. When Amos had first died, over 10 years ago now, the villagers had rallied around, bringing Irene home-cooked food and staying for a cuppa and a chat. But people had their own busy lives, and their interest soon waned. She'd hired part-time carers from agencies to help, but they weren't invested in the job, and most of them had poor English and couldn't provide the daily companionship she craved. It was just a means to an end for most of them, and they skimped on their duties and couldn't wait to get away at the end of each shift. Meanwhile, Michael stepped up without being asked. The general maintenance jobs on the cottages were kept on top of, and there were no complaints from the regular tenants back then, and the glowing reviews of holidaymakers continued. But Michael was working the same part-time hours as he had when Amos had been alive. One night, lying awake in bed because of pains in her legs, Irene realised that she hadn't seen a soul all day long. She thought about some of the decisions she'd made over the years, the way she'd neglected making friends because Amos was her world and she was his. Having each other had been enough for both of them. But now, the years had just evaporated, leaving her alone with no children and riddled with ill health. But her mind was intact, and that was the main thing. Nothing got past her. Nothing ever had. Amos had been old school, like his father before him. He'd never been a financial risk taker and had shied away from the stock market. Instead, he'd salted away large sums in a standard investment account, the sort where you had to give a minimum of 3 months' notice to withdraw or lose a disproportionate amount of interest. Yet Irene couldn't deny that his obsession with saving money had paid dividends, and his nest egg for a rainy day had been growing impressively. In that light bulb moment, she had realised that far from having nothing, she possessed what most other people craved: money. She had copious funds and nothing to spend it on. That was how it had started. The transformation from a life lived entirely alone to Irene Wadebridge's embrace by the great and good of Linwick. She made regular generous donations to the parish council, including sponsorship of the village's floral planting and various events like the Christmas lights turn-on. Her generosity brought many invitations to sit in on the parish council committee meetings, to join a new book club run by the village ladies group, to sponsor a reading award at the local school and present attendance prizes at the end of term. Someone would visit the house most days of the week regarding village matters. Others would just drop by to see how she was doing. They would partake of a cup of tea and a slice of cake, and it was only when they made a move to leave that they might remember some good cause they needed her help with. When her health had taken a downturn and she became less active on the village scene, Irene tried not to think about the reasons why her visitors quickly dropped off. In her quiet moments, it seemed fairly clear that people had made the effort not because they liked her, but because they liked her money. She'd known Michael Shaw since he was a small boy. Amos and Michael's father, Gus, had been close business associates,
and Irene knew Michael to be a hard worker because of his years as Amos's assistant at Wadebridge. So she'd offered him a position as property and land manager for a generous remuneration package that rivaled even Nottingham City's rates. Of course, Michael had snapped her hand off. Irene smiled to herself as she recalled his gratitude. It had been a good decision. Michael was the son she'd never had. He was always up here, even outside working hours. He was her first port of call if she needed help in any way, and she'd never known him to complain. When Michael got married, just a few years before Amos died, Irene had gotten friendly with Kate right away. When Tansy came along, and in the absence of any grandparents, Irene relished her time spent reading to her and doing arts and crafts. At key times of the year, Easter, summer, and Christmas, Irene would put something extra in Michael's pay packet. "Think of it as a small bonus," she told him if he protested. She went to the Shores on Christmas Day and Easter Sunday. She received invitations to Tansy's school play, her ballet and tap show. If she needed Michael or Kate, they would come at the drop of a hat, no questions asked. Irene stretched and shifted in her chair. Her perennially aching joints had kept her awake longer than usual last night. With the new anti-inflammatories Dr. Kendall had prescribed last week, she now took a total of 6 tablets twice a day. The medication took a surprising amount of time to organise, and she felt grateful that Kate took care of it. She pushed the walking frame away from the armchair and let her head sink back into the cushion.
"Where have you gone, Susie?"
she whispered into the silence. Michael had told her that Kate was taking care of Alex, but it wasn't the same as being at home, in the place you were used to, and the boy had already experienced so much upheaval in his life. Irene decided she'd speak to Kate and ask her to bring him up here to visit so she could comfort him. He loved playing Monopoly, a version of which he'd enjoyed back in Poland, and Irene had started to show him some simple card games, like Snap, which she enjoyed as much as he did. Irene was desperately worried about Susie, but she couldn't tell the police what she knew about Michael. Besides, she couldn't be certain that it was even connected with Susie's disappearance. What a mess it all was. When she read some of the traditional fairy tales to Tansy, she sometimes tacked on a nicer ending so her little charge didn't become upset. The story itself remained the same, with just a little tweak at the end. That was what she had to do now if the police questioned her again. The only thing that made any sense at all was for her to forget that she'd ever seen anything in the first place, and skip that bit of the story. Chapter 22. Kate. Donna's tea room was called the Larder, and was situated in what used to be the old post office in the centre of the village. She'd opened it 6 years ago, when the postmaster and his wife had retired and moved away. "It's always been my dream to run a vintage tea shop, and this is my chance," she'd told me excitedly when post office counters announced they were closing the branch permanently, despite fervent protests and a widely circulated petition. With Paul's full support, she'd snapped up the Grade 2 listed premises when it became available for rent. She employed a small team of part-time staff, a couple of students and a handful of local people. Between them, the cafe's opening hours of 8 until 5 each weekday were covered, with the students working the weekends. I'd been known to step in and help her out if she had staff off sick, if I could fit it in with my own work. Donna was a woman of contradictions. She was confident and forthright in village matters, but could transform into a jumpy, nervous woman whenever she thought Ellie was in danger, which was really most of the time. She clung to Paul as if she couldn't survive without him. I understood she felt insecure because of her past, but it stuck in my craw that Paul exploited that weakness when it came to his infidelities. I'd tried so many times to talk to Donna about it, but she'd always pushed me away. I walked into the larder and, as always, took pleasure in looking around at the pretty, traditional tea room. It highlighted another of Donna's contradictions. She was quite a practical woman when it came to her largely monochrome wardrobe and her love of Nordic-style interiors, and these preferences were reflected in the look of her home. So when she'd initially shown me a board of fabrics and colours she was considering for the tea room, ice cream colours and delicate florals, I'd been pleasantly surprised. A whole bunch of us, friends and family, had got stuck in at the weekends and transformed the dusty, dated post office space into this Laura Ashley-esque oasis on a budget. It hadn't been a chore at all. We'd had drinks and snacks and music and generally had a great time. Small white wooden tables and matching chairs were draped in white tablecloths, and all bore tiny pink blossom vases with fresh flowers in. The main wall was of exposed brick, softened with tiny white fairy lights. A local joiner had knocked together some rustic shelving from reclaimed wood from the post office counter and storeroom. These were now stacked high with a collection of quirkily mismatched bone china cups, saucers and side plates that Donna had sourced mainly online. Along the other wall was a counter displaying delicious homemade cakes from a local bakery under huge glass domes. Next to that, a couple of vintage Welsh dressers with stocks of sugared almonds, artisan biscuits and speciality teas for customers to purchase, the shelves artfully trimmed with pink and lemon flag bunting. Donna had managed to rescue the original wooden floor by back-breaking hours spent sanding and varnishing it. The overall result was a delightful space to enjoy a brew and relax. Needless to say, it had proven extremely popular with villagers and visitors alike. After the call from Miss Monsall, I'd texted Donna and told her I was on my way over. I didn't say why. She appeared from the back. "Sit down, Kate, and I'll bring us some tea. I'm just getting straight after the lunchtime rush." I sat at a table near the window. Donna brought over a plate of lemon curd shortbread that I resisted for all of 30 seconds. I'd just taken a bite when I felt my phone vibrate in my pocket. I snatched it out and answered the call with a full mouth. "Hello? Mrs. Shaw, my name is D.I. Helena Price, Nottinghamshire Police. Are you okay to talk for a moment or two?" My armpits instantly felt damp. I glanced at the counter, where Donna had begun preparing our drinks. Hastily, I swallowed down the shortbread. "That's fine, yes." I kept my voice upbeat. "How can I help?" Donna glanced across as she poured our tea from a big silver pot. She'd sensed my slightly formal tone. "I understand you have Alex Barros staying with you currently while his mother's missing?" "That's right." Michael's concerns whirled in my head. He'd want me to use this opportunity to inquire what they intended to do if Susie wasn't found soon. But I said nothing. "How is he bearing up?" "Not great, as you can imagine. But he's getting there," I said. "He's gone to school today." Donna frowned as she tried to make sense of my words. "That's good. We'd like to speak to Alex as soon as possible. Obviously, social services will have to get involved again if his mother isn't found. But for now, after school tomorrow would be perfect if you could accommodate us, and I..." "Yes, tomorrow is fine." I felt a bit put on the spot. "Great, let's say 4 p.m. then." She took a breath, but didn't pause long enough for me to answer. "Are you happy for us to come to the house, and for yourself to remain in the interview as Alex's appropriate adult? If not, I could ask his head teacher, see if someone from school wanted to attend." I hesitated. "Well, Alex needs to be as comfortable as possible, you see. It could make all the difference." It made sense. "Yes, okay then, I'll do it." We said our goodbyes, and I sat staring at my phone. I knew Michael wouldn't like the police at the house again, but what could I do? Donna came over with the tea. "Everything okay? I couldn't help overhearing your conversation, and you sounded a bit stressed." "Everything's fine," I said, reaching for the pretty Royal Albert cup and saucer in front of me. "Nice to catch a bit of peace with you in here." "I can see everything isn't fine." She began to chew a fingernail. "Look, Kate, If you know something, you need to tell me. I don't want Ellie in any danger if there's a maniac loose out there.
Donna, calm down. That was just the police saying they want to interview Alex.
She stared at me for a moment. Then, seemingly satisfied that I was telling the truth, she picked up her own cup.
This is my worst nightmare. Brings everything back. Matilda vanishing into thin air. Everyone coming up with theories. Everyone suddenly Hercule Poirot.
It must be awful for you. I reached over and touched her arm. What's the general consensus about what happened to Susie?
Donna blew on her tea before taking a sip.
I've heard various scenarios, but the current favourite seems to be that Susie just got tired of village life and the fact that she didn't really fit in and simply took off.
That's ridiculous, I said, biting into a biscuit and catching crumbs in my hand. Alex is Susie's world. She'd never just leave him behind like that.
Donna shrugged, pulling down the corners of her mouth. Like I say, it's just what people are surmising. Paul reckons she looks the sort to just take off. He was scathing about her, actually. Said,
what can you expect of a woman who dresses like a tart even for the school run?
Her cheeks bloomed with approval of his misplaced criticism.
Oh, I think that's a bit harsh, Donna.
Injustice burned in my throat at Paul making such disparaging remarks when he'd been following Susie around like a panting dog. I could see her chest rising and falling as her breathing became heavier.
Harsh may be, but that doesn't mean it's not true. I know it's early days, but after a massive search and a door-to-door, nothing's turned up yet, has it? She seems to have just done a moonlight flit.
I'm not sure how. She didn't drive, and Michael said the police had mentioned checking with a local taxi firm, who said no cab had been ordered.
Bus?
She bit her lip. I think someone would have seen her waiting at the bus stop, don't you? She looked at me over her cup, dissatisfied with my lack of agreement.
Well, what do you and Michael think?
We just don't know. I sighed. Michael is, I don't know, he seems a bit low at the moment. I think he feels like the police are suspicious of him because he works up at the cottages.
Donna's eyes widened. She placed her cup back on the saucer.
Why? What have they said?
It was just the routine door-to-door visit. They were quite probing and he was unnerved, I think.
They've accused him of knowing more than he's letting on.
She was instantly interested. And who could blame her? We'd been friends a long time, and I trusted her not to gossip, but I still found it difficult to discuss our personal business. It felt disloyal to Michael somehow. But Donna was like a dog with a bone. She'd studied my face and had seen something.
Look, don't say anything to anyone, but the police searched Susie's cottage and found Michael's work keys in there.
What?
Her eyes widened.
Had he been in there?
No, nothing like that. He swears he doesn't know why they were there, and that's what he told them.
She picked up her cup again.
Even so, the police must view it as suspicious.
When the officers came for the door-to-door, it was the way they questioned him, more than what they asked, I said.
The fact that he works for Irene Wadebridge seems to be a dead weight around his neck. Since then, he says they've been hanging around the cottages. He's been told to expect a more thorough search of the surrounding land soon, and he reckons they'll want to speak to him again.
That's awful. It's bringing it all back. That horrible feeling of being both desperate for and dreading information at the same time.
Donna pressed her fingers to her chin.
Do they suspect there might be something gruesome to find up at Wadebridge?
Who knows? I gave an involuntary shiver. But I feel really bad for Michael. He's completely innocent, but feels guilty by association, you know?
I suppose it's natural for the police to be asking questions, though, isn't it? Especially when they found his keys in her cottage. Young, attractive woman, older married man.
I stared at her. I felt shocked and affronted.
I can't believe you said that. And I'll thank you not to repeat it, Donna. That's how nasty rumours start in a small place like this.
She sniffed and sipped her tea. Sorry if I've upset you. I'm just saying what people around here will think. I can't sleep for all this trouble. I don't want to let Ellie out of my sight. Well, that's precisely why we should be careful what we say. I'm probably to blame for Michael feeling like he does too, with taking Alex in. Alex isn't your responsibility, Kate. I know that. I offered him a safe place with people he knows, rather than some faceless social services placement. It's a massive commitment, though, you must admit it. Yes, but I'd do the same for any child. I'd take Ellie in without hesitation if you went missing. And I'd take Tansy in, Donna shot back. But our girls are best friends. We're best friends. You hardly know Susie and Alex. And yet, Paul offered to have him at your house. Well, Paul says he didn't offer. Not in as many words, he just showed concern for where the boy was going to be taken. The lady from social services had told me herself that he'd offered. But seeing as Donna didn't approve, it sounded like he'd done his usual number and denied everything. Well, anyway, it might not be for much longer. The police are coming over tomorrow to speak to Alex, and then if Susie is still missing, social services might have to get involved again. I traced around the rim of my teacup with a fingertip. I admit I've probably bitten off more than I can chew, but I thought it was the right thing to do at the time. Michael thinks the same as you, that we should stay out of it. You've got a good heart, Kate, but when are you going to realise you can't save everyone single-handedly? I flinched. Have the police interviewed you and Paul? Our door-to-door was very quick. No awkward questions from the police, she said a little smugly. Did Paul tell them he'd spoken to Susie? The words were out of my mouth before I could stop them. What do you mean? It was too late to back out now. And besides, this could be important. When I took drinks over to Michael and Paul by the tree last night, Paul bolted off to talk to Susie as she walked by. I don't believe that. I was there, Donna. I saw him. Well, he must have had something to ask her, or perhaps she'd left something behind near the tree, or... Why do you let him treat you like this? Her mouth dropped open, and she stared at me. What are you talking about? I'd crossed a line, and I knew it. Through her refusal to discuss his affairs and the way she absolved him of any responsibility, Donna had let me know in no uncertain terms that Paul's behaviour wasn't up for scrutiny, and I'd fallen into line. Well, no more. Yes, I was discovering things about Michael that were shaking my faith in him, but Donna was more than happy to point those out to me, and I would do the same to her about Paul. The way he ogles other women in front of you, in front of Ellie. The way he's had affairs and you've just taken him right back without a... Enough! Have you thought about the message you're giving Ellie as she grows up? That it's okay for men to treat women that way? What if I said enough? Her teeth were bared aggressively, but her eyes were wide and scared. It's none of your business. It's nobody's business but ours. If that's how you feel about it, then fine, I said, purposely dropping my voice against her rising anger. I just wanted to... Well, don't. Don't just anything, okay? Keep your nasty little opinions to yourself. A tear trickled down her cheek, and she wiped it roughly away with the back of her hand. Me and Paul, we have something good. We've something worth fighting for, and he loves me. I know he does. It's nobody's business, not yours, not anyone's. Understood. I took a step back. I'm sorry you're so upset, Donna. I care about you and Ellie. I don't comment on your marriage, do I? I looked at her. Gone a bit quiet now. Nothing to say? We're talking about Paul's infidelity. Michael hasn't been unfaithful. Despite my loyalty to my husband, my heart drummed against my chest wall. All the things I'd discovered lately that he'd failed to tell me, was I in any position to criticise Donna? She put down her cup, and it made a sharp ching on the saucer. Kate, what's got into you? I know it's a difficult time with Michael feeling the heat, but there's really no need to take it out on me. I'm not taking it out on you. I'm just asking if Paul had mentioned he'd spoken to Susie. It doesn't take much for the police to become interested in a perfectly innocent person. That's the point I was trying to make earlier.
Donna nodded slowly, regarding me with fresh caution.
They're just doing the job, though. They found Michael's keys inside Susie's cottage. That would be considered a clue.
It looks suspicious, but Michael said he knows nothing about it, and I believe him. I looked down at my hand and saw a pile of broken biscuit crumbs beneath my fingers. I didn't mean to upset you, Donna. I know this brings everything back for you. I can't imagine how it feels to lose someone in this way. But that's why I felt so bad for Alex, you see.
When you texted to say you wanted to talk to me, I thought it was for a specific reason, not just to have a go. But anyway, let's just agree to differ on things. I'm sorry, I got distracted.
I clamped my hand to my forehead. The reason I came over was because of the kids, Tansy and Ellie. I told her about the call from Miss Monsall. I'm really sorry Ellie got caught up in it all, but it's a tough time for Tansy right now, too. She's being overprotective of Alex, and who can blame her?
Me! I can blame her!
Donna's eyes darkened.
Making Ellie cry at school! That's unacceptable, and actually...
She pushed her chair back and stood up.
It's not really Tansy's fault, is it? It's your fault. You're also overprotective of Alex, and Tansy's clearly picked up on that. She's turning into an interfering little... Hang on! Ellie's also a little madam at times, and you need to admit it, Donna.
Her observation of my need to protect and feel responsible for others hit home. But that was just me. What could I do about it? Everyone had parts of themselves they had to just accept and get on with.
Ellie hasn't dumped Tansy in favour of some kid who's been in the village just 2 minutes, has she? Fortunately, Ellie has lots of other friends. I'll be asking Miss Monsall to sit the two of them apart from now on.
Oh, come on, that's just... Donna leaned forward, her eyes gleaming, her jaw set.
You're blind to any of your family doing anything wrong. Maybe I'm not the only person who's gullible about their husband's excuses.
What are you talking about? Donna stalked off to the counter, and I stood up.
Hey, you can't say something like that and just walk away. You told me yourself, Michael's keys in Susie's cottage. That's a bit worrying, wouldn't you say?
I've got stuff to do now, Kate, and not sleeping's driving me crazy. I'm beginning to think this village is cursed. The tea room door chimed, and three customers came in, all mums from school.
Hey, Kate. Hi, Donna,
one of them sang out.
Excuse me.
I headed for the door and stepped outside into the cold, damp air. After Donna's comments, my mind was swimming with all sorts of possibilities. Part of me was aware that I was turning into exactly the sort of person I'd criticised her for being. After what Irene had told me about Michael's cosy breaks with Susie, and the police discovering his keys in the cottage, I was beginning to wonder if Donna was right, and I was being incredibly naive, just accepting his excuses. I decided to talk to him tonight, pin him down until I got the full truth of the matter.
Chapter 23. Later, I got to the school with just a minute to spare and skirted around the group of mothers that included Donna.
Is my mum back?
Alex said as soon as he and Tansy reached me. I saw Ellie stalk off in the opposite direction towards Donna.
Not yet, sweetie, but the police are working really hard to get her back home.
I watched him deflate in front of me and felt a squeeze in my chest.
Ellie's been horrible to Alex today, Tansy said, glaring down at their group. She said she's not my friend anymore.
Oh dear, I said. Not again. On the way out of the gates, I looked over to catch Donna's eye and offer a smile, but she'd turned her back and was talking animatedly to the other mums. Nobody acknowledged me. I took the kids straight back to the house and decided to say nothing to Tansy for now about the upset with Ellie. Both she and Alex looked tired and a bit down. I made their tea and let them chill out watching television and then playing computer games, but when I went through to get something, Alex spoke up.
When can I go home, Kate?
As soon as they find your mum, Alex.
I know it seems like forever to you, but it's only been a day.
Why hasn't she sent a message?
It would have been so easy to lie to him, but I wasn't going to do that. I don't know. I'm sure she would if she could, but we're hoping to hear something very soon. Glumly, he went back to his game, and I knew he'd found no comfort at all in my vague words. When Michael got home from work, late as usual, the kids were already in bed. He looked wretched. His face sagged, and he moved slowly, almost lumbering.
"I'm going up for a shower," he said, greeting me with a kiss on the cheek that I didn't return. "Wadebridge has been crawling with cops. They've searched the woodland again and all of the cottages, not just Susie's."
"Have they questioned you about the keys again?" He frowned.
"Not yet, but they probably will."
I could see the stress lines settling in around the corners of his eyes. "What does Irene think about it all?"
"It's a bit weird, but I think she's enjoying the attention and the company. She's worried about Susie, but seems to have blind faith that she'll turn up. Doesn't seem to realise the seriousness of the situation, or the fact that the police are trying to get their claws into me."
I felt sure that couldn't be the case. Nobody, not even Irene, liked having police intervention on their property. I wanted to discuss the stuff that was bothering me, but there was something else to tackle first. I told him about Miss Monsall's call. "Sounds like Tansy has been a little Rottweiler to the other kids. She's always been protective of her friends, but I said I'd have a word when she gets home. I haven't done so yet because they'd clearly had a tough day." Michael said nothing, but his face was like stone. I went to the tea room to speak to Donna, and she was really defensive. I challenged her about Paul treating her badly in front of Ellie, and she implied I was naive about you. He busied himself slipping off his work jacket and hanging it up, instead of tossing it on a chair like he usually would.
"In what way?"
She didn't elaborate, but I felt like she was implying you were involved with Susie Barras's disappearance. I suppose that was the crux of it.
"I hope you know that's rubbish," Michael cried out. "Utter rubbish. It doesn't take much for folks around here to start talking, and before you know it, you've got a kangaroo court on your hands."
"I agree, and I said as much," I sighed. "But there seems to be more and more stuff in the things I don't know pile, Michael. Stuff you've been keeping from me. Tea breaks with Susie, the fact that Irene reckons she's sweet on you. The keys." He groaned.
"Please don't tell me you believe Irene. It's all in her head. Honestly, she must be losing her marbles."
He grabbed my upper arms.
"I love you. Got it? Even if I have a cup of tea with Irene and a tenant one day, I love you. I haven't got a clue how those keys got there. I do tend to leave them around as they're not my most important bunch, but I hadn't been in a cottage for days, and I'd used them since. I told you all that."
If his goal had been to make me feel better, he'd failed. Yet it was in my nature to give him the benefit of the doubt, to believe in him. I decided to finish my news. "There's something else. The police called me this afternoon. They're coming here tomorrow, to the house, to speak to Alex."
"You see, this is what I meant, Kate. This is what I was worried about."
He fell quiet a moment, collected himself.
"Having the kid here has just put us all in the spotlight, got people's tongues wagging. Do you think you could speak to someone about getting him a temporary foster family or something?"
"You seriously want me to do that?" D.I. Price had already broached the subject, but Michael didn't know about that. This wasn't like my caring husband. He seemed uncharacteristically panicky. I had absolutely nothing to hide from the police. But what about Michael?
"Without Alex here, we'd be just another village family," he said in a placatory tone. "Instead, it feels like we're in the thick of the investigation."
"The detective said social services will be in touch about taking Alex, if you must know. But it's not him being here that's causing their increased interest in you. It's the fact you work up at Wadebridge. You were always going to be involved, Michael, whether you liked it or not." I tried to bite my tongue, but it didn't work. You cozying up in Susie's cottage wouldn't have done you much good either.
That's not what happened. How many more times?
He squeezed his eyes shut.
I can't stand this. It's like waiting to be shot. The coppers are biding their time, but they're after me. I know it.
He was starting to sound paranoid, completely overreacting. Unless there was more stuff he wasn't telling me.
Look, why don't you have that shower and then come downstairs and we'll talk. We can...
There was a knock at the door.
I'll get it, he said,
and headed for the hallway. I heard voices, and then the door closed, and the voices continued. I rushed into the hall and stopped dead.
Hello, Mrs. Shaw,
D.I. Helena Price said pleasantly. D.S. Brewster nodded.
They've got some questions for me, Michael said, his voice flat. We'll go into the front room.
The kids are in bed, I said, walking towards them. I'll come in too, if that's okay.
That's entirely up to Mr. Shaw, Brewster said. Sometimes people prefer to speak to us in private.
We all turned to Michael. He looked alarmed for a second, and then nodded.
Of course.
The detectives both declined drinks, and we all sat down.
Just some things we need tidying up,
Brewster said easily, taking out his notebook.
There's the matter of your keys being found on the kitchen worktop of Susie Barros's cottage the night she went missing, Mr. Shaw. Anything else you'd like to tell us about that?
I glanced at Michael, but he didn't look back at me. He stared straight ahead.
I have no idea how they got there, he said simply. Where do you usually keep them?
I don't really have a set place for them. I attach my main bunch of keys to my waist, but the second bunch, the ones you found, they're used less often. They're usually in my office or in the main house if I'm doing something there and forget to pick them back up.
Might you have been doing something in the cottage and forgot to pick them up in the same way?
Brewster said. Price looked at me, and I averted my eyes. I hadn't been in the cottage for about a week. I replaced a washer on the tap there, as I explained to the door-to-door officers. I've used the keys since then, so I know I didn't leave them there that day. Brewster made a note. I watched my husband carefully, saw tiny pricks of perspiration on his upper lip. Was he telling the truth? I thought so, but I couldn't say for sure.
We looked into Jakob's connection to Wadebridge, and it seems highly likely he was there at some point as a casual worker.
Price took a piece of paper out of her bag.
Earlier today, the team received an anonymous call claiming to have some important information,
she read from the paper.
If you're interested in finding Jakob Jasinski, ask Michael Shaw at Wadebridge, Linwick.
She looked at Michael.
There appears to be a growing trend of people going missing from your workplace. Who is Jakob Jasinski, Mr. Shaw?
I've never heard of him,
Michael said firmly.
Let me help you out. Jasinski is on our missing persons list, Brewster said. He disappeared from the East Midlands area over a year ago, by all accounts. His family back in Poland are understandably worried and are desperate to trace him.
That's as may be, but I can't help them, I'm afraid. I sat there mute and shocked. Jakob was a casual labourer who'd worked at Wadebridge for a couple of years. Michael had said he was a good worker, but one day, about a year ago, he hadn't turned up for work. And Michael hadn't seen him since.
Why on earth would he lie about that?
I chewed the inside of my cheek. I dared not look at D.I. Price, who I knew was studying my face.
Does the name mean anything to you, Mrs. Shaw? She asked,
her voice clear and cutting. I froze. This was the moment I either told the truth and got Michael arrested, or lied to the police. For the first time in my life.
Kate has nothing to do with Wadebridge operations, Michael said confidently.
I don't, I agreed, my heart thumping so hard I began to feel queasy. I wanted to protect him. I wanted to be honest. The conflict between the two cut me like a knife.
Do you employ many casual staff on Wadebridge land?
Brewster pressed him.
Sometimes we have, in the past. Michael said gruffly. But I haven't had any help for a long time. Brewster nodded.
Well, should you suddenly remember you do know Mr. Yuzinski after all, be sure to let us know, sir.
Chapter 24. When the detectives had gone, I rounded on Michael.
What the hell did you lie to them for? You know full well who Jakub Yuzinski is, and you know he worked up at Wadebridge.
Leave it, Kate.
He grabbed his wellies from the mat at the back door.
I need some space.
He stomped out into the dark and started pacing up and down like a madman. I pressed a switch, and the outside lights illuminated the small garden. I watched him from the warm, dry kitchen. 5 minutes after he'd gone out, it started to drizzle. When he showed no sign of coming inside, I called to him, but he waved me away without looking up. I knew something was wrong. I could see it in his slightly wild eyes, his lack of appetite, the way he'd disappeared into himself, so that I now felt I couldn't reach him. Being raised by an alcoholic trained you in spotting the signs of trouble that others might miss. The pattern following one of my mother's binges was always the same. The guilt and shame, the resolve to get help and stay off the drink. For a brief time, I'd get a glimpse of the tantalizing normality most of my classmates enjoyed. Things like having my mum at home when I got home from school, sitting together to eat tea and talk about our day, watching a movie on television with popcorn and soft drinks. But always, just as I allowed myself to consider the possibility that this time things could be different, the signs would start again. Always discreet and almost unnoticeable at first. Her restlessness, her inability to concentrate. The way that during a conversation, her eyes would gradually become unfocused, as if she were yearning to be somewhere else. And yet she'd swear there was nothing wrong. She'd swear she hadn't touched a drop. That's how she'd ended up in the car that day, because I wanted so badly to believe her when she said she hadn't been drinking. I let her take the keys and drive away. I went against my instincts, just as I was doing now. I watched Michael pacing almost manically in the rain now. He didn't seem to notice that his hair was sopping wet, his wellies tramping the lawn into a mud bath. My instincts said something was very wrong. I pulled on my own wellies and coat, grabbed an umbrella, and went outside. Susie's disappearance was getting to him. It was getting to us all. Little Alex was the one who was suffering most, but it felt like there was one thing after another to tie Michael to Susie Barros. So far, he was sticking to his story about the keys. I felt uncomfortable about it, but I had to accept she might have found them lying around outside somewhere and picked them up to give him the next day. Naive, maybe, but it was circumstantial. It didn't mean he had anything to do with her disappearance. Michael's first instinct, ever since I'd known him, was always to help if others needed him. He seemed to take pleasure in making people's lives easier. During our 15-year marriage, he'd been a thoughtful and loyal husband. He adored our daughter and had always managed to make time for us both, even though he often spread himself too thin. He cared about Irene and, admittedly, to my irritation at times, would come out at the drop of a hat if she needed help. He could never have been described as a sly or underhand man, because he just wasn't, which made recent events and observations so incongruous. I didn't quite believe them, but they were too serious to ignore. You can't let it get to you like this, I said, throwing my hands up. You can't start lying about things that can probably be checked out. Why did you lie? He stopped pacing and looked at me.
You knew the truth, but you didn't say you knew him, did you?
I was speechless. It seemed so unfair when I'd kept my mouth shut to save dropping him in it. I took a step back, my heart pounding against my chest. I looked at my husband, his square jaw, his strong, wide shoulders, his dependability. We'd always been so solid together. Now it felt like he was turning on me.
What do you think they'd have done if I'd admitted I knew Jakub? They'd tear me to pieces to get their conviction. That's how they operate.
He took several steps forward.
They're closing in on me, Kate. I can feel it. They keep finding excuses to come up to Wadebridge. And after finding those keys, they can smell blood. It feels like it's only a matter of time before they pin something bad on me. Something really bad.
The rain came down harder, sheeting at me at an angle and defying the umbrella. The collar of my jacket felt sopping against my neck, and I adjusted the brolly so he could see my face again. We looked at each other for a long moment.
"Have you got anything to do with Susie Barros's disappearance, Michael?" I asked.
"No.
I want the truth, no matter how bad."
"I've done nothing wrong," he said solemnly. "You have to believe me, Kate, because if they manage to get enough dirt to stick, they could even pull you into all this as well. Say you lied to protect me. What would that do to Tansy? We could lose everything, including our daughter."
While Michael was in the shower, I rang Donna's mobile. It rang for a while, and I thought she wasn't going to pick up. Then she answered in a surly tone.
"Kate, hi."
"Hi, Donna. Listen, I just wanted to say sorry for having a go at the tea room. I'm stressed, Michael's stressed, the kids are stressed. We're living in a bit of a nightmare here."
"If anyone understands how you're feeling, it's me," Donna said. "But I'm not going to deny you upset me today. Attacking Paul and then justifying Tansy making Ellie cry. She was still in a state when she got out of school. Have you spoken to Tansy about it?"
"Yes," I lied. I couldn't stand animosity with Donna on top of everything else that was happening. "She knows she's done wrong, and she's going to apologise to Ellie tomorrow."
"Right. Well, let's put it behind us then. How's Alex?"
"He's confused, upset, everything you'd expect, really, though he doesn't say much.
When are the police coming to speak to him?"
"Tomorrow after school. They're coming here to the house."
"Give me a ring afterwards. Let me know how it goes," she said. "Maybe we can have a get-together after school one day this week."
I could have done without it, frankly, but I wanted to get back on an even keel.
"That'll be great. Thanks, Donna."
When I put the phone down, I felt as if I'd gone a bit cap in hand to her, but if that was the price I had to pay, then so be it. That was what being friends was all about, wasn't it? Give and take. And I needed Donna. I needed her friendship and support to get through this tough time. I mean, things were bad enough right now, but who knew what was around the corner?
Chapter 25, 12th of November, 2019. Nottinghamshire Police. D.I. Helena Price stared out of the window as Brewster drove through the pretty village in a marked police car, the only car available. Linwick was well kept, with small shops and interesting landmarks like ancient stone crosses, and small channels of water that ran either side of the main road, which were known locally as docks. As the car slowed and turned off the main road into a smaller side street, she noted the curious glances, people commenting and pointing. Nothing went unnoticed in a place like this. And yet it seemed that a young woman had somehow disappeared at a busy event without anyone seeing a thing. In Helena's experience, small, claustrophobic places could either be a blessing in disguise, in that people saw everything, or a barrier that outsiders, including the police, were unable to break through. She hoped the former observation would apply this time. As they pulled up, Helena leaned forward to get her first look at Kate and Michael Shaw's house. It was a modest, detached home, neat and stone-built, with a small front garden, quite unremarkable in this village, which boasted several impressively large houses with plenty of land. It was Kate who answered the door. She was a tall woman, with dark hair pinned up at the back, and escaped tendrils framing her pleasant, open face. After introductions, she led Helena and Brewster into the hallway.
"Do we have to wait for someone to come from school?" Kate asked.
"No, I spoke to the head teacher at Linwick Primary, and we decided we'd just keep it low-key. The least people here, the better," Helena said.
"Alex seemed very nervous when I said you were coming to chat with him," Kate said, dropping her voice to little more than a whisper.
He doesn't say much, even to us. Doesn't show much emotion, even if we mention his mum. It's quite worrying, really. She looked at Helena. You might be wasting your time here, I'm afraid.
Helena nodded. That's always a possibility, but we'll see. Children often did not behave in the way adults thought they should in times of trauma. Adults tended to release emotion and display visual signs of worry and grief. Some children were the opposite to that, and completely closed up, like an oyster shell. It was a way of protecting themselves when they felt vulnerable and exposed. Kate led them through to the living room, where Alex sat waiting. His hair was very dark, almost black, and his skin was pale. Dark circles underscored his hooded eyes. He didn't look up when they entered the room, but chewed furiously on the inside of his cheek. When they moved closer, he crossed his hands in front of him, essentially another safety barrier.
Hello, Alex. I'm Helena Price. I'm a detective leading the investigation to find your mum. This is Kane Brewster. He's a detective too.
Hi, Alex, Brewster said warmly, crouching down at the side of his armchair. I'm here to try to help. We want to get your mum back here where she belongs.
Kate Shaw smiled and nodded at Alex reassuringly. The boy shuffled closer to the other arm of his chair, subconsciously trying to get as far away as possible. It was a normal reaction Helena had seen before. She stood up and walked over to the chair facing him. Alex, I know you're very upset and worried about your mum. She sat down. I want you to know my team are doing everything they can to find her, okay?
Yes, Alex said in a small voice, steepling his fingers together in front of him.
I've come to see you today because there's something else we can do to help find her. Something only you can help us with.
Alex glanced at Kate and sat up a little straighter. I have a few questions I need to ask you. Nothing difficult or upsetting, but things that could help us find your mum. Do you understand?
The boy slumped a little.
It doesn't matter if you don't know the answers, and if you want me to stop, then you just have to say and we'll leave. Do you think we might have a little try?
Alex knotted his fingers together securely and frowned at the shining white knuckles that popped up. Kate Shaw said helpfully, I'll be sitting here with you the whole time. What do you think?
Alex looked at Helena and Brewster, then back at Kate. He gave a single nod.
Well done, Kate said. Your mum will be so proud you did this brave thing.
Thank you, Alex.
Helena moved on swiftly before nerves got the better of him. Now, I know you and your mum came here to the UK from Poland. That's where you lived before? He nodded.
It must have been difficult for you to leave your home, she said softly.
I was sad to leave my friends and Banjo, my rabbit.
Of course, she said. And your mum, she must have missed her family.
Alex shifted in his seat. When children of this age hesitated to communicate, it wasn't always, Helena found, because they didn't have the answers. It could be that they'd been told to stay quiet by an adult. She waited. The house felt silent and cool. The light outside was dropping and cast the room in a dull bloom.
She missed her friend, Alex said.
Which friend is that?
Petra.
Ah, yes, Brewster confirmed, as if he knew who he was referring to. You saw a lot of Petra, yes?
He nodded.
She worked with my mum at the bakery, and sometimes she'd bring cakes for our picnics.
Helena grinned. You lucky thing! And that was the bakery in... She looked up at the ceiling as if she were trying to recall the place name. Alex watched her.
Hard for me to remember Polish place names. I think it's in...
Tarnów,
Alex said. Tarnów, of course. Helena stuck her index finger in the air. Thank you, Alex. Brewster wrote something down.
Alex, could you tell us your address back in Poland? It's really important we know exactly where you lived there, because...
Too late, Helena threw him a warning look.
No!
Two pink spots glowed on his pale cheeks.
It's okay, Helena soothed him. Remember, you don't have to talk about anything that makes you feel uncomfortable.
Alex nodded and folded his arms. But you know, it would be really useful to know your address back in Poland, because then, if your family are worried about your mum not contacting them, we can let them know you're all right.
I can't remember the address, he said stiffly.
Helena knew the child was reluctantly responding with clearly rehearsed dead-end answers. Alex had probably been told by his mother to issue this stock reply if asked any details about their life in Poland. That was why it was important to avoid direct questions like Brewster had asked, and take an indirect approach instead.
Alex, she said softly, waiting until he looked up. Sometimes, when adults tell children to keep quiet about something, it's because they're feeling scared too. Maybe your mother